What caused you to want to reunite ELP?
Well, there's been, you know, for many years, there's been discussions about, you know, putting ELP back together again. And I think it was just a question of this was the right time in the right place, you know. It's where we were, it's where we where it all began, really, for us in England. And we thought this was a, you know, a good opportunity to do it. Hopefully more will follow, you know, but we just felt that it was time to do it now, you know, and that was it, really. And Keith and I had been, actually probably what even spurred that on further, Keith and I had been doing some writing together. And so that was the initial thing which triggered all of this off.
Writing you've been doing with Keith.
Yeah, well, we just started sort of songwriting and compiling some music again. And, you know, when we started writing it together, we were sitting in my studio at home and playing through some of the old things together. And we just decided that it would, you know, there was an interesting aspect to listening to just the two of us working, which was the way, of course, all the ELP material was written. And we started to think about doing this as a live show, because it's a sort of different aspect that people would never have seen of how the material really came about. And in a way, it's a performance in and of itself. It's a kind of different version of all of that material, in a way. And we thought that it would make an interesting show. And so what we did, we decided to put it together, and essentially what we're going to do is, on stage, we're going to create a recording studio, and we're going to perform this stuff in the environment of a recording studio. And that's how it'll be.
Well, how would you describe exactly the things that you're going to be performing in the very near future?
I don't know. I mean, that's too broad a question. It's, I wouldn't describe them, other than to say that to say what I just said, and that is that, you know, it's a different version of the material that was written and created for ELP that people have never heard from that perspective. In other words, it was the way it was written in its very early initial stages. We're also going to perform stuff from King Crimson and The Nice, both of which will be seen from the same perspective.
Well, how would you say that your writing, both your writing and your collaboration with Mr. Emerson, how has that evolved since you started working together with ELP?
I don't know. I think probably, I mean, essentially we're the same people and the same musicians with the same souls. So in many ways, it is the same thing. But obviously, you know, the years we've had much more life experience now, and I suppose the years have taught us something. There's a maturity, perhaps. I suppose that's the best way of putting it. There's a type of maturity about the writing now, where we've got a lot more of life's experiences to draw upon. I think that's probably the main difference. But I mean, from the point of view of our musicality, we're pretty much the same people. We don't try and pretend we're anything other than that, you know. So it's pretty much what you would expect. I think if anyone was to hear what we're writing now, they would immediately say, yeah, that's Keith Emerson and Greg Lake. It's identifiable.
All right. Well, speaking of being more mature as musicians and as writers, how has that affected the way you've reinterpreted the work that you did with King Crimson and ELP?
I think by the same token, I mean, in a way, we've tried to be honest in the sense that the idea emerged, and so the it begins at least in a very emergent way, a very bare bones, stripped down sort of way. And I think that is the fascination with it. What we have tried to do is, as the material develops, we've tried to offer new interpretations, new possibilities of ways of performing the material. So, in other words, you hear it before it became what people now recognize it for, and then we sort of offer an alternative version, which is, beyond the recognized version. So it's kind of two perspectives, really. It's before it started, and after it became successful.
All right, and in reuniting with the two of you with Carl Palmer, how do you think that's going to be with the three of you coming together after such divergent experiences after leaving ELP?
It'll be like the reuniting of a family, really. I don't think it'll be anything other than that. We all know each other so well. We've lived together for so many years that I don't think there'll be any real surprises. We're just all a bit older. We probably all learned to value each other more than when we were originally in the band together, because when you look back, you really do appreciate what the other people had to offer, and that's in a reflective sort of way. And I think that probably all of us bring some of that into this new situation.
All right, well, speaking of reuniting and writing new material, what are your plans for creating new music with the reunited lineup, if you have any?
We haven't really discussed that at this point. Whether we actually make another record or not, I couldn't tell you. There's always a possibility, and something I would always leave the door open to. The same goes for Keith and myself. We were writing really just as an experiment, and we'll see where it leads, we'll see what comes of it. It's like an ongoing process, and, when we feel the time's right, I think we'll probably put a record together. But that's for the future, really.
All right, well, speaking of live performing, ELP was always known for its explosive live show. To what extent are you feeling of bringing that back for your live show, or what are you planning on doing differently?
I think it'll contain all the elements that ELP always used to be known for. ELP was always a pretty theatrical and, as you say, explosive type of performance, and certainly that will be the case. I mean, we certainly don't want to put on a show where people would look at it and say, well, they're not as good as they used to be, or, it wasn't as I remember it. So we're very alert to that. But we hope there'll be a few new surprises in it as well, a part of ELP's is that there was always something of the unexpected about it, and I think that's what we'll still try and maintain.
Not to take away some of the surprises of seeing the live show, but what plans do you have for reinterpreting classical music, something that ELP was always known to do?
Obviously perform things like Bad Death
is there anything else you'd like to say about the upcoming tour before we move on to other questions?
No, I don't think so. I think that it will be a surprise to people. I think that they will see a perspective of Keith and I that they would not have seen before. It will obviously be a very intimate show because these are small venues, really, for Keith and myself. But we feel that it is that they're the right places to perform this type of a show in, and we just think people will enjoy it. We're enjoying it very much, and I think that's always a good sign.
Speaking of working with orchestras, I've always been curious about the song Pirates off of Works. What was the genesis for that song?
It started, Keith had written this music, and I think originally he had written it with a view to putting on a movie. The movie actually was called The Dogs of War. And I think he'd been talking to the director of that film at the time. Anyway, somehow the music didn't get used for that. And Keith really, really liked the music. So one day he played it to me and he said, look, you know, I've got this music that I really like and maybe we could use this with ELP. And so I said to him, I listened to the music. And I said, yeah, that's really fantastic. Have you got any idea of how what you think it could be about? And he said, well, I think it's about mercenaries, military mercenaries. And I said, well, I can't really see writing songs about that. It just doesn't sound like a very healthy subject to be writing songs about. But I said, I'll give it some thought. Anyway, when I got back home and I started to play the music again, for some reason, it put me in mind of the sea. The music had that sort of oceanic texture to it. It reminded me of the sea. And then I reflected on what Keith had talked about mercenaries, which he obviously got from the idea for this film, The Dogs of War. And then I put the two things together, and I thought, pirates. Pirates are on the sea, and pirates are mercenaries, but pirates have this sort of romantic kind of storybook acceptance, and all of a sudden it all started to run through my mind that it might be possible to develop a story up around the subject of pirates. Because they're very colourful characters, and the history's colourful, and they were sort of daredevil people, and they were romantic figures, and so that's how it came about, really.
Well, one of the things about that song that's always struck me as being different from the rest of the body of ELP's work is the lyrics, and they're poetic in a very different way from what you're accustomed to hearing from ELP. Where was the inspiration for the lyrics?
Well, it came from pirates. That was it, who will make his mark, the captain cried, to the devil drink a toast. This was the pirate captain summoning a crew. He was summoning a crew up to go to sea. And that was where the lyrics came from. And they just unfolded. Pirate language is very colourful. It's full of these images, it's very interesting, actually, that you land on that piece as a question, because it's one of the things that Keith and I will be performing in our two-man show. As an example to you of, the sort of strangeness that I think you'll encounter, but Pirates is a lovely piece, and as I got to write it more and more, I realised that, it was very rich in images. I actually wrote it with Pete Sinfield, the lyrics, and we had a great time writing them. What we did, we bought every pirate book and we watched every pirate film that had ever been made. And so we researched the subject of pirates really deeply. We researched the history, the actual history of pirates very deeply. And so we became very knowledgeable about the subject. And then we wrote the piece. So we wrote it really in the full knowledge of what pirates were historically, and of course what they were fictionally, and in the sort of more romantic sense. And I think that blend of that perceptive blend really is what makes those lyrics as colourful as they are.
All right. Well, speaking of pirates and the album Works, tell me about that album and how it came to be written.
The Works album was a strange moment because it was really the end of an era. I think at the time, Keith felt as though he had done everything he could within the confines of a three-piece band using synthesizers. Whether he would feel like that now today is another matter. But at the time, I think, he felt as though he pushed the limits, he pushed everything as far as he could, and I think he was running out of space and ways to go within the confines of a three-piece band, just using synths. And that was when the idea of orchestras came in, you know. And at first, we were going to actually take a break from the LP, and we were all going to do solo albums. And that was the first thing we talked about. Because we were also all very tired of touring. We used to tour, I don't know, 200 days a year, 250 days a year. And it was so much touring that we really became fatigued. And I think there was part of us wanted to stop touring. And the other part really wanted to play some different music. And I think the idea at the time was really to maybe take a break from the LP and do something different. But, of course, you know, the record companies were very interested in us continuing because obviously we were selling millions of albums. And so, you know, we were encouraged basically to make another band album. And so what we did is we came up with the idea of actually developing a concept in which we could encompass all of these things by having a side of the album each as a solo side, and one side devoted to the band, and that's where Pirates are fitted. And that was really the concept of Works Volume 1. Works Volume 2 really was material that we recorded and had left over, and we didn't have room to put it on Works Volume 1, so that became Works Volume 2.
Alright, well, how about the side you wrote? Tell me about that one generally.
Generally, I think it was a collection of songs which I'd obviously written on acoustic guitar, but that I'd written symphonically, you know, with a view to them being performed by an orchestra. So you get things like C'est la Vie, Lend Your Love to Me Tonight, Closer to Believing, all of them basically symphonic in nature. More than that, I can't tell you that. I mean, that's it, really. The songs are what they are. They were written, as I say, so that they fitted in within this orchestral structure. And that was about it.
I imagine at this point you're probably sick to death of talking about I Believe in Father Christmas.
Yeah, it's a bit much around Christmas time. But I'm happy to talk about it now to you.
All right, well, I have two questions about it. The first is a little more of a conceptual thing. Artists such as yourself often, their musical personalities, it seems to me, are often encapsulated in songs that they wrote years and years ago, and, you know, now you're such a different person. How do you feel that your identity should be tied up in songs that you wrote like that, and how much do you feel that it applies to you today?
You know, that's an awfully difficult question to answer in truth, because in a way, you cannot escape from the songs you wrote, and nor do I want to. I mean, I'm proud of the songs I wrote, and I feel that they were part of me, and I've got no wish to hide from them. But in another sense, a song is a creation. It's not really you, it is something you create. It's something that's come through you, but it stands alone as a creation. And as you rightly point out, you know, as one grows older, you become a different person because your life experiences make you into that different person. And so, you know, you're not the same. I'm not the same person now that wrote Lucky Man when I was 12 years old. But I still identify with it, and somewhere in that song, there's still the 12-year-old Greg Lake, and there's still the 21-year-old Greg Lake, or the 24-year-old Greg Lake, in the Christmas song. And I think the one thing that, if I am to be just a little bit arrogant about it, I would say what I'm proud of is that, in a way, those songs have stood the test of time. They don't sound dated now, and the lyrics are pretty relevant, you know. I mean, the Christmas song was written not actually to be a pop song at Christmas or a hit single or, you know, or a sort of catchy Christmas song. It was actually written to be quite a serious commentary on the way that Christmas has become nothing more than a commercial selling opportunity. And that we've lost the sort of real meaning of Christmas, which was goodwill on earth, peace to all men, and goodwill on earth. And we've lost that, and we've exchanged it for, you know, how many presents can we buy? And it drives everybody crazy at Christmas, you know, trying to find the money to buy all these presents. And the real essence of Christmas got lost. And that's what that Christmas song's actually about. But it just happened to get, it got picked up on British radio, and it became a hit. And really, it was only intended ever to be an album track. I mean, not that I'm unhappy that it became a hit record in that way. I mean, I'm very happy it did, but it was never written with that in mind. I'm sorry, I've kind of wandered off of what you originally asked, but that's the story on the Christmas song, really.
Somewhat of an off-topic question, but since you're known for writing a song about having lost the meaning of Christmas, what would you say the true meaning of Christmas is?
Well, it means different things to different people. To some people, it's a religious, you know, it's an overtly religious event, you know. For me, it was part religious and part community. When I was a kid, you know, and where I grew up, there was this thing of this community feeling of, you know, you would always patch everything up at Christmas, even people you didn't like. You'd try and be nice to them, or, you know, if you had a row with somebody, that would be a time you'd patch it all up, you know. And it was a time to show goodwill to people. And what it did, I think it was a sense of refocusing. It was a sense of bringing things back to reminding yourself, really, that you should have goodwill for people and you should have compassion and care about your fellow man. That was really what it was. And this was the symbol of this, to me, was Father Christmas, the character. This giving character, this happy character, and hence the title, I Believe in Father Christmas, you know, because it wasn't just about focusing on religion or the religious side of Christmas, even though, good though that may be, you know, good though that may be, and I'm very happy that people have that
was the reason for including the quote from the Lieutenant Kiji suite in that song?
What it was I've written, how the song began, I came up with this little guitar riff, you know, you can hear it on the record, it's just a descending sort of arpeggio on the guitar, and I was trying to, for some reason I liked it, and I was trying to think of a song that I could put with it, and the song that kept going through my mind was Jingle Bells, right? I couldn't get it out of my head, so then the idea occurred, well, maybe I should try and write a song based around the idea of Christmas. And so that was the first thing that happened. Pizza killed by, somehow we wrote the Christmas song. And then it came to recording it, and I said to Keith, you know, Keith, can you have a listen to this and see if you've got any ideas? And I played it to Keith, and he said, you know, maybe you could put in the chorus this little bit of the Lieutenant PJ suite. And he played it, and it just fitted perfectly. So that's how that ended up being there.
How do you feel about your music being covered in general?
Generally, of course, it's an honor. You know, it's a real honor to have someone cover your music and play your songs and so forth. It is a strange feeling sometimes to hear people expressing the same emotions that I've tried to express. And then you hear them expressing them themselves. It's a rather strange feeling it gives you. It's not just someone copying the words or copying the notes. It's actually expressing the feelings. It's very interesting to hear someone else try and express the same feeling, the exact same feeling that you were trying to express. That's quite an interesting moment. But overall, you know, it's a tremendous honor, really, I have to say. And it always gives me a tremendous pleasure to hear our music played by people. It's a wonderful thing, wonderful feeling.
What's some of the things you did solo-wise after you split from ELP?
The live things I did mainly were... I formed a solo band. I did a solo tour in England, which I was very proud of. Wonderful band, and we recorded that on DVD. That was a great experience for me, just because the players were so fantastic, a wonderful group. And I did a tour with Ringo here in the United States, which was a real pleasure. Fantastic band, and Ringo was a real joy to work with. I recorded on the Who's last single. It was called Good Looking Boy. That was a fun thing to do. I played occasionally with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Funnily enough, I was in Cleveland 2 years ago with Trans-Siberian. I've done a few live things like that. Generally, you know, kept busy writing and so forth. So that's really been the things I've mainly done.
Being as how you're considered one of the first and biggest figures in the progressive rock movement, how do you feel that you've progressed as a musician since leaving ELP?
Not much, really. I think that most of your progressing is done in your youth. You know, that's when you are most adventurous, I suppose, indeed, most progressive, you know. I still believe in the concept of progressive music, because I think that without it, younger, my music and performance would have been better if I'd have had these things. But on the other hand, I had the energy and the inspiration of youth going for me. So, you know, at different ages in life, thank God, there are different benefits. You know, so getting old is not all that bad because you've got some rewards attached to it. Not many, but some.
Other artists who started when you did have moved on to solo careers that have gone in various directions, but it seems like, to give two examples, Peter Gabriel and Steve Hackett are trying to keep their solo work interesting by moving into world music and different ways of presenting sounds. How do you try to keep your music interesting as you continue writing?
You know, I'm not that sort of person, really. I've got no sort of public conscience. I do what I want to do. When I make music, I always try and do it the best I possibly can, because I believe I owe it to the public to do that. If I'm going to play and perform it, and if I'm going to sell it on a record, I'm very conscious of doing it as well as I possibly can. Other than that, I've got no interest in, you know, I don't owe anybody anything. I've got no interest in fulfilling expectations or adhering to some prescribed timetable or anything like that. None of them. So I'm not in that mindset that I need to keep coming out with, you know, a song every week or an album every 6 months, or else people will forget about me. I'm not worried about it, you know. So that's. In that way, I think I'm different to the people you just mentioned. It's just the way I always play that. What it is about art, I think about art is, it's something that you've got to want to do. And if you want to do it, it's beautiful. You know, you're doing it out of free spirit. It's a free spirit is doing it. I don't think, when I don't want to do it, I just don't do it. And I think it is very unhealthy to have this feeling of, oh, I'd better come out with something in case people think I've gone dry or something like that. You know, that's not art. But then you're just manufacturing music to meet some sort of expectation, timetable. And then I think that's phony. And I never want to be a phony. So I only make music when I want to. And then I do it 110%, because I say this is because when it's going to be sold to people, when people are going to pay to come and see it or pay to buy a record, then I've got a duty to those people to make sure it's fantastic or as good as I can do it. That concerns me more. That's what concerns me, is making sure that I've get my end of that bargain in a way. I look at it like when you write a check out at the bank, you know, a check isn't really money, it's a promise to pay. But when I make a record, that to me is like a banker's check. It's a promise to pay at some time in the future when I come and perform live. That's how I look at it.
In recent years, there's been a fair amount of bedlam raised in the music community about stealing music and that sort of thing. What is your opinion on stealing music digitally and such things?
Well, you know, the problem is that you can no longer protect intellectual copyright. That means that, you know, if I write a song today, as soon as I commit it to a recording, it becomes commercially valueless, because someone can
since you're someone who's been in the popular music business since the mid-60s, and is, I think, even a casual observer would say you've maintained integrity through that time, what do you think has caused the dumbing down intellectually of what is considered popular music and what you would hear on the radio? When I mention to people that I interview people such as yourself for my radio show, one of the first things I hear is, oh, wow, they must be, completely burned out. Because, you know, when people think of ELP, they think of a band that sold gold records in the 1970s, so they kind of compare you in their minds to the Stones and people who really abused their bodies in their stardom. And I guess I have to ask, do you think that one of the reasons why you and Keith have maintained to be creative people who've really stood apart from the rest of the 70s crop of rock musicians because you had more respect for yourself as artists and as for your bodies?
Well, I'd like to say that was true, but I don't think so, no. I think that life in rock and roll can be very hard. It's a very, you know, you're living on the edge all the time. And it is it's a nervous business. You know, you're always concerned about your writing and is it good enough, and you know, it's a business of it's tough on your nervous system. That's the first thing. And that's why people I think it was Sharon Osbourne who put it about Ozzy Osbourne, that she used the term self-medicating, you know. And people do, you know, to ease the pressure, to ease the tension. And I suppose to a certain extent, everyone in rock and roll has been through some of that. Well, I know I have, and so has Keith. And so the Stones, and so most people in rock and roll music. It is that sort of a life. You either survive it or it kills you, quite frankly. A lot of the people I knew in the late 60s, they did, you know, they weren't so lucky, and during their period of excess, they just got unlucky and took the wrong combination at the wrong time, and ended up dead, you know. I think if you survive that and come through it, then you tend to value your health a lot more. And so, from a purely physical perspective, I think that's the sort of bottom line of it. Other than that, though, we all get older, and we all get creaks and squeaks, you know, and you've got to do what you can to stay healthy, and try and stay healthy and be happy, stay away from stress as much as possible, and, you know, just, I mean, the thing is, you know, every human being knows within themselves if something's going wrong, you know, and when it does, all you can do is to be alert to it and say, look, you know, I'm going to take this in hand before it damages me. And
speaking of excess, I don't mean to offend with this question, but I've always been curious about the true story behind the Persian rug that you had on stage, and I've never really known what the true story was, and I'd like to hear it from the horse's mouth.
The true story of the Persian rug was that one night, early on in the career of the LP, we were playing a concert in Germany, and I got electrocuted. The microphone was live, and I got electrocuted in the head. So the current went through my head, through my arms, into the guitar, and that's how it got. The danger of that is that it goes across your heart. And that's how it kills you. And so, you know, after that, the roadies put down a rubber mat for me. You know, I insisted having, you know, standing on something rubber. And so they put this rubber mat down. But unfortunately, it looked terrible on the stage, you know. So I said to the roadies, look, can't you cover that up with something? Can I get some carpet? Just cover it up, you know, thinking they would just get, like, you know, some carpet on the stage, like regular carpet you put on a floor, you know. Anyway, the roadie comes back some hours later with this rug. He'd gone out in London and he bought this rug. And he said, look what I've got. And he rolled this rug out on the floor. And it was this beautiful Persian rug.